Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road, when along came a semi with a high and canvas covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Of travel I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Well, thank you very much, Audrey. Thanks again, and welcome back. Audrey's been traveling on the holiday vacation, and she came back to help us do the show tonight. Can you believe that? She is such a faithful and talented show producer and introducer. She does a great job. But thank you, Audrey, and welcome, ladies and gentlemen. This will be our last edition of the show for 2017. Yes, a New Year's coming up. I think that's Monday, isn't it, Audrey? New Year's Day will be January 1st. We're going to take a little different turn with the show in January. You won't be able to recognize it probably right away, but one of the things we're considering doing is entering into the, okay, don't throw anything at me, Audrey, the social media world. Yes, the social media world. I don't do that. I don't Twitter. I don't Instagram. I don't Facebook. I don't do any of those things. I mean, that's No, I don't do it. But we're going to maybe get into the Twitter business, but don't quote me on that. But anyway, tonight I think you'll enjoy what we're going to do as our last show for 2017. We're going to listen to Cheryl Atkinson. I don't know if you ever listened to her on NBC. She's on Sunday mornings. I 10 o'clock, maybe 9, yeah, 10 o'clock, maybe 9 o'clock. But she is a very informed and talented news researcher and reporter, and a researcher on all kinds of things. She has special shows about special topics where she goes in depth. She doesn't do four sentences about something, but her show is about, it's called The Smear, and it's about researching and media picking out somebody they don't like or something, and then gathering forces to sort of destroy, I don't mean physically, but to take out the credibility of somebody who may, in fact, be very credible in terms of what they're doing in society, be that politician, be that somebody in the criminal justice system or whatever. But she is very talented, and I think you'll enjoy listening to her. Remember, you're on the Blog Talk Radio Network, and what could you do for 2017, do you know that you could have your own radio show in 2017? It wouldn't cost you one penny. You can go to blogtalkradio.com and sign up, and you could be signed up in about 3 to 5 minutes. Start your show with 30 minutes, hour, whatever, and you'd be broadcasting worldwide. You would be broadcasting, yes, worldwide And isn't that something? We've been doing it. We've been doing it a long time. What we try to do on this show is dedicate the show to these tireless courts, police, corrections, and juvenile justice people, and they'll be protecting us big time here on New Year's Eve. I forget how many police officers are going to be in Times Square to protect the 1 million people that are going to show up. Can you believe that? I guess my grandson lives in New York City. He just took off. Yesterday he came down for Christmas, and I just can't imagine that. But they're going to have 1 million people in Times Square, and you know the jihadists and folks, the terrorists, they all want to do something terrible, but Times Square may not be the place that they're going to do it. Anyway, what we try to do is look inside criminal justice and other fields and get the best information we can about those. So just remember, any person, any interest group, any organization can have their own show and broadcasting on worldwide in audio, radio. Imagine somebody in 1940s radio hearing about that. They wouldn't believe it, would they? I mean, what an age we're living in. Can we control all of this? Anyway, all right, let's take a look at some of the criminal justice news. There are certainly some interesting things going on. Let me point some of them out here. When I get my news tab up, and here's one that I just can't stand. I am not a big fan of pit bulldogs. I know some of you may be listening. You have a pit bull. That's the most wonderful thing you've ever seen. Well, this woman in Virginia, they finally found her. She went out to walk her two pit bulls like she always did. And guess what? They killed her. The two pit bulls attacked her and killed her. And they finally found her. And it took them like 2 hours, I think. Each of these pit bulls weighed 125 pounds. And when I was a street cop a long time back in the Ice Age, a long time ago, pit bulls were just sort of coming on the scene. And they were terrible. I mean, they would bite people constantly, and you'd cops, I can't remember who did it, but cops sometimes would have to shoot them, that type of thing. These dogs, they said, that killed this woman, they appeared to have been bred for fighting. And that was, remember, they used to have pit bull fights, and people would bet on them and all that. Is dog fighting still going on? Have you heard anything about that? I never do, but that was a big gambling thing years ago. But isn't that terrible that this woman would be taken out? He had some robber boys real busy down in Cincinnati over the holidays. Two of these guys, one's only 17 years old, robbed 14 businesses in just a few days. I think it was 4 days. I mean, they're real busy. They robbed convenience stores, gas stations, 14 different businesses, and even a bank. The adults apparently stayed in the getaway car. They sent in the juvenile to do the real footwork on the crimes. But isn't that creepy? Nations and overdosers. Guess what state leads in drug overdose deaths? You would probably never guess it unless you're reading the newspapers. West Virginia. West Virginia, it's 52 per 100,000. In 2016, Ohio was second with a rate of 39. New Hampshire is third. Isn't that incredible? There were more than 63,600 drug overdoses in the United States. And you hear these crazy stories where these people have to call the police two and three times a weekend where they've overdosed. And unbelievable. The deadliest drug was the synthetic opioid fentanyl, which was linked to more than 19,400 deaths. The rate of drug overdose deaths connected to synthetic opioids doubled in just one year. Isn't that terrible? Hey, back to pit bulls. I should have added this story before the last one. The new administration in Montreal, Canada, recently kept a campaign promise. Guess what they promised? They're going to scrap the city's regulations against pit bull ownership. There are still places in the United States that don't allow you to have a pit bull. But anyway, we want to make sure that Montrealers are safe, and we want to prevent dog bites, says Mayor Valerie Plante. I think it's Plante, P-L-A-N-T-E. Might be Plante. But anyway, she said that last week in the Canadian press. So you can take your pit bull to Montreal and you'll be absolutely safe. And if you're out walking the streets, I'd suggest taking something along with you in case one of them pit bulls decides to check you out for one reason or another. This is really great. I am fascinated with this, ladies and gentlemen. I just read, and my son-in-law told me that that's not a new idea. Or no, one of my friends told me that. Wasn't my son-in-law. And he said that, they're saying that Walmart will let you camp out in their parking lot overnight. Did you know that? You can save a buck. You can pull up your camper, your car, sleep in the car. You can't use lawn chairs. They won't allow lawn chairs, but you can stay there, and when the sun comes up and you're all done, get out of your van and or get in your van and take off, and you're going. But free overnight stays in Walmart parking lots. And you might actually go in the store and buy something. And maybe they got discounts for campers. What do you think, Audrey? Oh, that could be. Okay, officer deaths in the line of duty. Oh, boy. Number of law enforcement officers killed in the line of duty dropped sharply in 2017, making the second lowest toll in more than 50 years. All right, that is just absolutely great. That is great. The best. We need our law enforcement officers, and we need to protect them. The reasons for the drop could range from a bad safety gear, such as bulletproof vests, better training, better relationships, and reduced violence in communities. And that might have something to do with it. But anyway, it's not great. As of Thursday, 129 officers have died in the line of duty, with 44 shot and killed. That down 10% from 2016, when 143 officers died, with 66 gunned down. And we must really, you know, we talk about rewarding people for their service, but in the middle of the night when nobody else is there, whether it be fire, burglars, break-in crimes, whatever it is, who do you call? You call the cops, and the cops show up. And we really need to recognize the triumph of what they do in terms of saving our lives. But anyway, car crashes, they get killed in that too. But anyway, here's one of the stupidest articles I've ever read in my life. This was in our local paper. After living in Washington for nearly 1 year, President Donald Trump has yet to enjoy a single non-working meal at a restaurant that doesn't pay him rent. He hasn't taken in a performance at the Kennedy Center. He hasn't gone to a sporting event. He hasn't toured much of the sites. I think one of the reasons for that is because he works constantly. He gets up early and stays late, and anybody that knows him actually realizes that. And he is good at what? The art of the deal. And we're seeing some of that already. But isn't that incredible that they're talking about, you know, he only golfs on properties he owns. He's only dined in just one restaurant. In the BLT Prime and Trump International Hotel. Now, what should he be doing? Walking down the streets of Washington, going in and stopping in every store and whatever? I think that would be a big Secret Service cost in order to do that. But they didn't report what size his shoes are, though. That's bad reporting, right, Audrey? He did visit the Smithsonian New Black History Museum last February, during Black History Month. But the Trumps have kept a much lower profile than previous presidents. And I'm telling you, I just don't know how to take that. It just it's awful.
Ah.
It is, okay. It's just awful. New York City murder rate. Did we talk about that? Yeah. That's wonderful. The lowest rate they've had in 50 years. 286 murders as of Wednesday, putting the city on pace to finish the year with fewer than 300 murders for the first time since 1950s. Murders in 2017 are down from 329 at the same point last year and 2,260 in 90. Can you believe that? 2,262 in 1990. Now they're down to 300. And I'm not going to go through this very long article. They talk a little bit about crime analysis and that type of thing. And I am a co-author of a book with Mark Stallo, very innovative and one of the leaders in the crime analysis field. But you know what else New York figured out? If you take the really bad guys and lock them up, they can't rape on the street, they can't shoot people, they can't, et cetera, et cetera. New York has stuck to that. It's a democratic city by far. Some would say a liberal city, but they have figured out we want a low crime rate. And we hope those kind of things hold up on Monday or Monday or Sunday night for New Year's Eve. But anyway, isn't that something? let me see if we're done. Dosher's death overnight. Pretty much all we got to talk about here. I would go into smartphone addiction, but I won't. Some of you are smartphone addicts, so I better shut my mouth. But anyway, I know it's very valuable to you, that type of thing. But you know, a lot of people that quit smartphone and get off of social media and stop texting, they report that life is better for them. I can't imagine that. How could you ever put it down? I still see the woman in my town who talks on the phone and texts and turns at the same time, turns her vehicle. That takes a lot of skill. That's enough for now. Let me give you, let's get a green tip. We always do that. Now's a good time to talk about it. Because of all the waste and packaging that comes with Christmas presents. our green tip for tonight from Esma Floyd's book, 1001 Ways to Save the Planet. Excuse me. I've got my usual January cold, or December, January. Buy recycled paper when you can. Paper is 40% of solid waste. 72 million tons annually when that book was written, Esma Floyd's book. And quality is about the same. So if you buy recycled paper, you will help save the planet. And you can't beat that. All right, here's our blonde joke for tonight. Keep in mind, this is a blonde man. A blonde notices that his coworker has a thermos. So he asks him, what's it for? He responds, it keeps hot things hot and cold things cold. The blonde immediately buys one for himself. The next day, he goes to work and proudly displays it. His coworker asks, what do you have in that? What do you have in that thermos? She replies, soup and ice cream. Hey, it takes care of both, but not at the same time. All right. That's it for tonight. I think what we're ready to do now, give me time to get set up, and we're going to listen to Cheryl Atkinson talk about her book, and she is really good in her business. And give me a little time to set this thing up, and we'll be real back with Cheryl Atkinson talking about her book, The Smear. We're getting close.
I appreciate it. And as we continue here from Miami, we're pleased to be joined by journalist and author Cheryl Atkinson, whose most recent book is called The Smear, How Shady Political Operatives and Fake News Control What You See, What You Think, and How You Vote. Well, Cheryl Atkinson, I think you had a chance to listen to those final few calls that we heard. Mm-hmm. And Liz Ann in Santa Rosa, California, thinks that people were duped often into voting for Donald Trump.
Well, there is that view out there. But as I talk about in The Smear, I think if you actually watch the rallies of Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, I tried to watch almost every one. And if you talk to people outside the big cities, which I did a lot of, that's what led me to predict that Donald Trump would be president when so many others couldn't see that. I think you get a different picture than this sort of stereotype that's bandied about commonly.
So tie the smear in to election 2016. Were there campaigns going on sub rosa?
Totally. I mean, I think 2016 was really the epitome of all the culmination of factors, whether it's social media, these smear groups, the smear industry in Washington, D.C. that's grown to these huge levels, all the tactics they use, everything came into play in 2016. And more money was spent, I mean, just gazillions, more actually by Hillary Clinton and her supporters than on Donald Trump, far more. And yet, I guess the lesson is, even though, in my view, as I say in the book, the liberal side and the Hillary Clinton side tended to permeate the press, and the narrative against Trump was ubiquitous, and yet he won. So I guess the commentary of that is that despite all the money spent, despite many Republicans, Democrats, and the media that were against Donald Trump, he somehow defied the smear, and that's why I call him the wild card candidate in the book.
What is the smear industry?
The smear industry is a collection of groups that I've defined, and some of them are paid groups, nonprofits. I'll give examples. PR firms that have crisis management functions, LLCs, global law firms. They're nonprofits, they're charities in some cases, they're websites. They all work together, or they all have components that are designed to take down ideas that they oppose, often by personally attacking the people most eloquent at expressing the ideas they oppose. And what differentiates, I like to say, at least in my definition, a smear from the truth, because there are often elements of truth within the smear, but its purpose is rooted in annihilation. And those who are directing the smear are often hidden from the public. They want to remain invisible. They want it to look like there's an organic kind of grassroots effort going on when they're actually pulling the strings, often in a very organized and well-financed way, to smear an idea or people or group.
Can you put a dollar figure on what this industry has grown into?
I can't. I think it's multi-billion, but because it's not broken down that way, let's say every PR firm has a component of crisis management that falls under this category, but it's not broken down that way, you know, how much they spend on that. But it's big money. Everybody knows that when the call goes in, when someone has to defend themselves or deflect, or when someone wants to attack and a call goes in to the crisis management folks or the strategic communications people, these are often elements of smears at their most basic level. But there are also many hidden ways that smears go on, whether they're paid people making comments on the Federal Register, whether there are people that are paid to rent the use of their name to sign op-eds. I would say a huge number of op-eds, if not the majority, are now orchestrated and written by somebody else but signed by someone. And the newspapers know this, and the publications often know this. It's sort of an open secret, but that's part of how ideas are sometimes either forwarded or stopped and or people are smeared.
Cheryl Atkinson, we've also been hearing recently about opposition research firms and their role in smearing. Is this also a growing industry?
Absolutely. I mean, opposition research is key to nearly every serious campaign, unfortunately. I mean, if you're just an average American that doesn't want to think that dirt is dug up, but I guess candidates have to do their due diligence. They want to find out, you know, what they'll know. Sometimes they oppo research themselves to find out what's findable about themselves, but that, too, is a big industry, and those people get paid a lot of money.
What are you doing these days? By the way, we want to take calls for Cheryl Atkinson. In case you're interested in talking about this topic, 202-748-8200 if you live in the East and Central time zones, 202-748-8201 for those of you in the Mountain and Pacific time zones. So what's your day job these days?
My time is largely consumed producing my weekly show called Full Measure with Cheryl Atkinson, and it appears on Sinclair stations nationwide. We're expanding really week by week to more stations. We see the 43 million households now, ABC, NBC, CBS, Fox, CW, Telemundo. And that's basically a straight news show that's going to do.
Her Full Measure show is really very interesting every week.
Stories that have not been done to death all week. For example, my lead story this week, I visited three countries, the Philippines, Singapore, and Korea, to talk about China's One Belt, One Road economic policy, which really threatens to put the United States in a back seat in Southeast Asia. Well, why should we care about?
You mean she's a journalist that actually gets up and goes out and studies something?
About that? I spent a lot of time trying to have people explain that and explain it in fairly simple terms so people can kind of grasp some of these concepts they don't have a lot of time to research for themselves.
Is there a tie-in between your first book, Stonewalled, and your second book, The Smear?
I think so. I consider The Smear a sort of sequel because Stonewalled covered the time when I was at CBS and I saw the emergence of these movements to control the news and these groups that were becoming very good at getting their nose under the tent at news organizations to influence what we do put on TV and what we don't put on TV. I've been left CBS, and this book takes it further, looks deeply in the industry, inside the industry in a way I don't think has been done before, that has developed largely unseen by the American public, but a multi-billion dollar industry that has the smear at its roots, at least what I call the smear.
I don't think you've ever really publicly discussed your personal politics, but in many levels you're presumed to be a conservative.
I think now that's definitely the propaganda that's been put out, which is fine if people want to think that. I used to be called, I think, largely liberal. So I think you could pick pieces of what I've done over the years and make an argument that I'm anti-corporate, pro-corporate, liberal, conservative, whatever you want to cherry pick. But I try to take a look at stories that are underserved that maybe others aren't doing to death or angles that are underserved on stories and just take a common sense look at it and ask questions. So I have many devoted liberal fans. I have many devoted conservative fans to the program. I have received investigative Emmy Awards for investigating. My most recent was for investigating Republicans, not liberals, but I have also won them for investigating liberals. Most of my reporting, historically, I'm really not very interested in politics. I don't like it. It seems to come into play or people want to pigeonhole what you do into a political hole, but most of what I do is non-political. It's more just watchdogging whatever the powers may be.
In The Smear, David Brock plays a pretty large role.
David Brock is a fascinating character, and I devoted a lot of ink to him because the people I interviewed, both the conservative smear artists and the liberal smear artists alike, named him almost in every instance as someone who is uniquely successful at what he's done with his network of nonprofits, LLCs, websites under many different names, to appear as though they are neutral, sometimes authorities, to appear as though many people are behind them when it's really a fairly small group. They've been extremely successful at their campaigns against people who go against Hillary Clinton or the other ideas that David Brock supports and his billionaire donors. And he's also fascinating because you probably know he began as a conservative smear artist going after the Clintons, which we talk about in the book quite a bit, and then he switched sides and became someone who worked for the Clintons, smearing people on the other side. So for many reasons, he's a really fascinating character.
Cheryl Atkinson is our guest. Esperanza is calling in locally from Miami Beach, Florida. Hi, Esperanza.
Yes. Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I don't consider myself neither Republican or Democrat or even independent. I have voted for both parties accordingly. Whenever election comes, I just make my own research and vote according with who I think is the best for this great country that I fell in love since I arrived the first time, being a legal immigrant, just come to school, a private school to learn English in 1966. I found this great country that I fell in love so much. After I finished my school here, I went to Europe.
The immigration issue was gigantic. I knew for many, many years that somebody who would touch the immigration issue would win.
Guillermo, thank you very much. Cheryl Atkinson, does the smear cover the 2016 campaign and whether or not there were forces working for either Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump?
That's a big part of the book in the end. We plan to just sort of wrap it up right after the election with the results, and then that happened and the fake news trend happened, which I dug into the origins of fake news and the phrase as I think a propaganda term. And so a large part of the book toward the end became to be about that. But I wanted to say, Yellow Dog Democrat, I think, means he's got maybe some less liberal tendencies. I'm trying to remember, maybe fiscally conservative. But...
Well, the subtitle of her book, I didn't mention it, but it's very interesting. The book title is The Smear, : How Shady Political Operatives and Fake News Control What You See, What You Think, and How You Vote.
A Yellow Dog Democrat is somebody who will vote for the Democrat, even if it's a yellow dog. The blue dog Democrats were the more moderate Democrats.
Well, maybe it was Esperanza then. It just reminded me of something when we ask people what their political leanings are, and the gentleman that just spoke, in it, I think
Guillermo.
He said he votes for Trump, even though he's a yellow dog.
He would not vote for him, even though he touched a nerve.
I got you. Okay.
I apologize if you're having, apologize for that.
I think the point is, one point I would like to make is, I think many Americans are not in a box. If you say, are you liberal or conservative? Are you Democrat or Republican? I think many Americans are sort of on a sliding scale. On some issues, they may feel one way. On other issues, they may feel another. And then they're constantly in a bit of flux depending on their personal experiences. And our system tends to box people in or try to force them to de-box in because how our election system works. And I talk to a lot of people who don't feel comfortable in either of those boxes.
Okay. You mentioned that you looked for the origin of fake news. What did you find?
Well, when it rolled out, it felt like the rollout of a propaganda campaign because it went from, and I Googled this, almost never in use as a phrase to suddenly every headline every day. And I remember when President Obama first introduced this, it's not by chance, he spoke at Carnegie Mellon, and he said there was a need for people, to someone to curate the news. And I thought, no one's clamoring for anyone to curate their news. Where is this coming from? So I did some investigation and learned I traced the origins of the effort to September 13, 2016, when a nonprofit called First Draft came up with this idea to go after news hoaxes and fake news, and then the rollout happened from there. President Obama got on board. The news every day was talking about it. Hillary Clinton got on board. And it initiated as a liberal effort, in my view, to steer people away from stories they didn't like, and some of them were blatantly false. There are many of conservative misinformation websites, for example. But at its heart, I feel like it was possibly an effort to shape and censor information, the last place where it's really free, where people can go on the Internet and the media doesn't control it and Democrats and Republicans don't control it. I looked into who funded First Draft because I like to follow the money when I see these things appear from nowhere. And their tax filings weren't filed, even though they're a nonprofit. They're waiting for their nonprofit status. And they told me that their funding came from Google. And as you know, Google's parent company, Alphabet, is run by Eric Schmidt, who started this First Draft initiative was started around the beginning of the election cycle. Eric Schmidt, as you may know, became a top Hillary donor, offered himself up as a strategist to her campaign. It starts to look like a coordinated effort, not that there's anything illegal or improper about it, but a coordinated effort to focus people on fake news. Then, to make this long story a little bit longer, but not much, I talk about in the book how Donald Trump, being the wild card that he is, was able to co-opt the phrase where today people think he came up with it, who don't know the origins. And I say it was more of a hostile takeover. He certainly didn't invent the phrase.
Well, I was going to ask you, and you kind of answered that as you went through the sequence, how a group, First Draft, you called it?
Yes.
Take a phrase, and it would reach President Obama. I mean, there had to be a line there, and you see that line is going through Google and Eric Schmidt, correct?
Yes, I see that there was an effort on a broad scale among the people that shape narratives every day in the news to put fake news on the plate of Americans. There was a plan. There was a rollout of this campaign, but it got out of their hands, and I think Donald Trump may be the only politician that could have done what he did. He just said every time they called him that, he called them that. And pretty soon, by January of 2017, the Washington Post, who loved that phrase for a while, was crying uncle and saying, we need to retire that phrase. We need to stop using that phrase. So, you know, part of the mastery of Donald Trump and his own ability to turn around propaganda or initiate his own propaganda.
Cheryl Atkinson's most recent book is called The Smear, and Martha is calling in from Wichita, Kansas. Martha, you're on with journalist and author Cheryl Atkinson.
Hello, Ms. Atkinson. I'm calling because I recently saw a program on HBO called Last Week Tonight with John Oliver, And on that program, he was giving a story of the one-sided kind of national feed that was sent through Sinclair stations to their local networks on their local news programs, and showing that the story was not changed in any way and read exactly the same on each station. And I don't remember the story, but it was rather one-sided. And I don't know if you're familiar with that program. But my question, I think, is and related to Sinclair Broadcasting. And since you're a broadcaster, you may not know their politics too much. But do you think that Sinclair Broadcasting is supporting a build-or-release various companies in local markets to in the control of multi-local stations and newspapers? If you understand that question, it was that, again, that
Martha, I think to the media ownership changes that the FCC is looking at currently, possibly.
Exactly.
Sinclair is looking at a merger with the Tribune Broadcasting Company. Cheryl Atkinson,
gotcha.
Anything there that you can or will address?
Yes, I can't tell you anything about corporate policy. My program is done under Sinclair, and there's been a large propaganda movement. People who wouldn't normally know about or hear about station owners, now there's comedy shows, as I discussed in the book, that are part of the propaganda campaign to attack Sinclair, which is seen as a threat by the people who dominate the media landscape now and by people of certain political affiliations. Sinclair's owner is a conservative, wealthy, I think, billionaire, the ownership of them, just as, you know, I worked for liberal billionaires when I worked at CNN, Ted Turner, and when I worked at CBS, Les Moonves and Sumner Redstone. There are people connected politically who work at the top of these organizations who contribute money to Democrats and Republicans. I don't remember everybody questioning it when I worked for the liberal people for 30 years. It didn't really impact, as I saw, our news on a daily basis. Those corporate bosses did not get intertwined with our daily news coverage. Now, there were other issues that did happen that I write about, but it's not as though Sumner Redstone, Les Moonves, or Ted Turner came into the newsroom and influenced our coverage. In fact, I think Ted Turner really worked hard when I was at CNN to make it stay factual at the time. Likewise, Sinclair at the top, the conservative who does head Sinclair, has not interfered with my program. I've had no interference compared to CNN. I'm sorry, CBS toward the end had a great deal of interference trying to do independent stories. It's been a freshness that I can't describe to be able to go into another independent program that doesn't try to shape the news and put out narratives. These are legitimate questions to be asked. I certainly don't blame people for saying, Dr. Sinclair is owned by a conservative guy. What does that mean for your news? But I would argue they should be asking the same questions, in fairness, of the predominantly liberal organizations that I've worked for in the past, that also send out stories every day from analysts who are one-sided, that are must-runs on all the affiliates, that are seen by many more people than the Sinclair station. So you have to dig in and wonder why only one station owner is getting all this press on comedy talk shows and on Capitol Hill when the others have existed in that same bailiwick for so long, kind of unquestioningly, at least by the same people.
Now, who is the owner of Sinclair? What's his name?
David Smith, and he's probably not the owner. He's just the one that I dealt with when I was being hired. We discussed about my program being independent, and I said, you know, I wasn't really planning to work again in the business necessarily. And when they proposed an idea for me to do a program just like I used to do, the reporting I used to do at CBS, which was just original in nature and investigative, I said it cannot be conservative. It cannot be any more conservative than my stories at CBS were conservative or liberal. And he said, you don't worry about that. He goes, if you just tell people the truth, they'll probably be conservative. I said, well, we can tell the truth and haven't had really a bit of interference. So, again, less interference working for the conservative billionaire than I certainly had at CBS the last 2 years working for the liberal billionaire.
That's the book, Stonewall, your first book.
Right.
Cheryl Atkinson, you alluded to this, but the power of the Internet when it comes to the smear campaign.
You know, I almost got chills when I was speaking with one smear operator who's a military guy. who said, you know, we can start a whole movement in 140 characters and a handful of fake Twitter accounts. And you look at the solicitations the government has put online, where it's soliciting software for people to maintain social media accounts, fake social media accounts, but it looks like they each have individual IP addresses that rotate. They do it with connections where if you look up these people, they'll have friends that look real and they'll be friends with people you know. They'll look like they do things and go places. Why is the government, why are corporations, why are political forces maintaining these fake accounts? Well, they know social media is the number one way to influence opinion right now, whether it's votes or whatever they may, ideas they want, may want to get out. And they virtually control that dynamic in many ways. And when he talked about that, it kind of gave me chills. I also say, you know, a rumor or innuendo or fake news, if you want to call it that, that would have been seen by relatively few people and died quickly before the Internet, can now develop a global following overnight. And then the technological tricks that are available to manipulate images and photography and video to make it look like something happened that didn't, this stuff has just been, you know, kind of vomited out there on our landscape and is you know, hard to separate fact from fiction. Very
Let's
difficult.
Hear from another caller. This is Elizabeth in Crested Butte, Colorado. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hello. You know, I'm about to lose my mind. I'm tired of being patient with everybody. I think that Donald Trump is a depraved moral coward and that his supporters are deliberately ignorant and dumb as a box of rocks. Thank you.
And that was Elizabeth in Crested Butte, Colorado. Barbie is in Newark, New Jersey. Barbie, you're on with author and journalist Cheryl Atkinson.
Hi, Cheryl. I have a couple of questions. My brother once told me, Barbara, you have enemies. And then he wouldn't tell me who my enemies are, so maybe my own brother is my enemy. How does one, plus I've been banned from academic associations, and they wouldn't tell me why I was banned, just that I made people uncomfortable in my presentations. And I just wanted to know, how does a person, an individual who doesn't have much money, how do they find out if they do have enemies, if they're laughed at and called crazy and paranoid? And, you know, a lot of paranoid people are called paranoid, and then they find out that we're telling the truth, you know, people are trying to kill me, and then they get killed. And then the other thing I wanted to know is, do you know what news stands for? Benjamin Franklin said what news stands for, N-E-W-S. And then the final thing
is
do you know anything about dark social? Because,
hey, Barbie.
Yeah.
Barbie, tell us, what does news stand for via Benjamin
North,
Franklin?
East, West, and South.
Very good. Thank you, Barbie, for calling in. Cheryl Atkinson, without addressing whatever Barbie's situation is directly, have you ever been the target of a smear campaign, high level, low level?
Stonewall and the smear, that I saw these organized groups going against not just me, but other news reporters, Pulitzer Prize winners, New York Times expert reporters. When they would get too close, it almost is as if you can expect more organized blowback of from them calling the station, calling corporate forces, working on social media against you to controversialize you and your reporting. The closer you get to an important truth, the more of that you'll see. And I remember saying to CBS's lawyers some years ago, I said, this industry that's manipulating the news and calling and pressuring us, I said, they've got nothing but time. This is their job, time and money, and we're ill-equipped to kind of fight back. We're always playing defense after the fact, which isn't very effective. I said, shouldn't we be developing some sort of strategy so that we know this exists, we know what's going to happen on social media when we get close to a good story? But nobody has the time. You know, we're just busy covering the news and doing our job against these multi-billion dollar industries who are well-connected. They will do ethically questionable things and perfectly legal things, but they have a lot of money and time to controversialize reporters and stories to try to stop reporting on a line of inquiry. So, yes, I've been targeted many smears, but when I go to the investigative reporter conferences and I have other journalists complain of the same thing, but in a fearful sense, because it's not as though they fear the groups like Media Matters, David Brock, or the conservative equivalents that try to do that, but they fear that their bosses listen to them. They know that these are astroturf efforts that don't genuinely represent segment of the public the way they pretend. They know what it's all about, but they're afraid their bosses are moved and motivated by these social media campaigns and by all the pushback and the quasi-news blogosphere that's largely controlled by these people that will write articles that support them. It's a deep network. So, yes, and it is tough. The woman's talking about being called paranoid and all of that. Those are key words that are used that are have been tested that are very effective to use against your enemy if you're a propagandist. You call them mentally unstable. There's certain words I mention in Stonewall that you'll see over and over again kind of a way to detect that a smear might be going on because there's key phrases and words they use against people and ideas.
So earlier on today here at the Miami Book Fair, we were talking with author Jefferson Morley about his new biography on James Angleton of the CIA. He was talking about how Mr. Angleton had developed kind of a deep state within the states. When it comes to this smear campaign in politics, do you believe that there is a deep state, a sub rosa state within the state controlling
some
levers?
It depends on how you define it, but I know because I have many great sources under the Obama administration. I have many sources under the Trump administration and different federal agencies. Some of them were there under Clinton and Bush. Some of the same people persist from administration to administration. And I often argue it's not the president at the top that is pulling a lot of strings. It's that group of faceless bureaucrats that most people don't know their name, but they're controlling the information that goes up to the president, and they're controlling information that comes down, and they're making sure certain things do and don't happen. There definitely is that, you know, that layer, and everybody who's been in D.C. long enough knows that. We know people who work in that layer. So I do think there's an element of that. I'm not sure if it fits the criteria of deep state. You know, people have different ideas of what they mean by that, but there definitely are people who, whoever the president is, whether it's Obama, Clinton, Bush, or Trump, who disagree with that president and just wait it out because they know they will be there longer than that president will be there.
Next call for Cheryl Atkinson comes from Jane, Joshua Tree, California. Jane, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I'd like to speak to Cheryl's first statement, or very early statement, that this move, the movement to control the news, and that gets my vote. I'm a person that loves radio. I was traveling across the country to take care of my elders in Washington State, and that turned on that radio dial. And year by year, the radio band became, the viewpoint on that radio band became narrower, narrower, and narrower. I live 20 miles from 29 Palms Marine Base. As I get up into the high desert, I turn on my radio dial, and it's four very, very far-right Christian preachers yelling and saying anybody doesn't think exactly the way they do are evil. And then it's Rush Limbaugh on three channels at the same stations at the same time, spewing hate. This kind of vitriol and hatred that's been infecting the airwaves for 30 years and now is at a crescendo point where radio stations in San Francisco, radio stations in Santa Fe, radio stations in Seattle, all alternative voices are gone except for maybe an NPR station. You know,
all right, Jane, I think we got the idea. Conservative radio, and then Jane's view, a takeover of radio.
I have not studied that phenomenon. I don't refer to it. I do know there's just the general idea that liberal interests control much of the broadcast and conservative television broadcast and conservative interests control much of the radio broadcast. When I'm talking about control of the news, I'm not speaking to the industry bandwidth and that sort of thing. I just don't know about that. I'm talking about how special interests from both parties and corporations have been able to, as I say, get their nose under the tent in newsrooms, not just influence us with their talking points and their lists and kind of make us report what they want us to report on a given day, make us focus on that. We've also hired them in our newsrooms as analysts and pundits and sometimes managers and reporters. So now there's very little difference between the talking points we would be getting from an outsider and the talking points that you get when you turn on the news, and there's a reason for that. Some of the people who work there aren't interested in journalism and giving the facts. They're interested in promulgating talking points. And then because we often invite talking points from both sides on, we call it fair, when all you're getting really is either state-run media or propaganda or corporate propaganda, in my view, rather than reporters digging up original stories that people do not want to see on TV. If someone brings me a story, that's usually a story I don't want to tell because enough people are telling it. See that as a diversion from something else that could be more important. But too often today, it's very easy for someone, I don't know if people know this, but PR firms and law firms and so on, bring stories to reporters, bring research, bring narratives, have them on email lists. And reporters often, especially quasi-reporters in the non-journalist world, that sort of mix of blogs and so on that do some news and some other stuff, they will lap that stuff up and happily forward it further without their own investigation and research. And this is what I'm talking about when I talk about control of the news.
Cheryl Atkinson, a couple of years ago, I think maybe during the 2014 congressional campaign, the Koch brothers became a big issue and kind of an evil issue for the Democrats. They'd be on the Senate floor and Harry Reid would rail against the Koch brothers. And it turns out that most Americans didn't know who the Koch brothers were, but did that begin as a smear campaign, do you know? I mean, was that a coordinated campaign?
Yes. Oh, that was definitely coordinated. Although, as I say, at the heart of many smears, as my definition of the book is, there are grains of truth. The reason I call them smears is because the people who are trying to destroy the people or ideas are not upfront about their true motivations. They're often trying to, they have political interests that are rooted in annihilation of a target. It's not so much that they're really trying to expose what they say on the surface. They're trying to expose, they're trying to remove an enemy or an effective spokesman for a cause, for example. The Koch brothers are interesting. I Googled today because someone raised this question. There are so many charts done on their ubiquitous ties, you know, and all the groups sort of like David Brock I've done in my book, The Smear. They're so easy to find. I did that when I was researching the book. So many people have focused on the Kochs and the Koch brothers. And I started to focus on them a bit, but they pretty much stepped back, by the way, in campaign 2016. So they're in my book, but not in the starring role they might have had if they had supported Trump versus David Brock and his group supporting Hillary Clinton. The Koch brothers, like many Republicans or many conservatives, did not like Donald Trump and did not spend money on him. They kind of sat it out, which is, I think, very unusual. But it's part of the reason why Hillary Clinton far outmatched Donald Trump in terms of fundraising.
Next call for Cheryl Atkinson comes from Guy in Reading, PA. Hi, Guy.
I just want to put this out there that I think the First Amendment got Trump elected because there's a lot of hate out there. 8 years as office in the land, a lot of these people were not even political, but decided that they were going to vote Trump because, in their words, he speaks their language.
Guy, I apologize. I'm going to hang up on you. I think I was having trouble. The first words I heard, and then there was a lot of breakup, but he talked about the birther movement. Did you trace that one back to an organized smear campaign?
Yes. I mean, according to those who were first to report on it, it was started by Hillary Clinton, her supporters, when she was running against Barack Obama. There were quite a few smears from her very expert smear artists that were allegedly responsible for quite a few of the big smears against Barack Obama when they were competitors. And then the conservative side picked up on those, the smears that were generated in some cases by Hillary Clinton. The conservatives liked those and took some of those and they took on a new life of their own. But that, I believe, there's pretty good documentation I mentioned in the book, anecdotal documentation by reporters involved, that was pitched to them by one of Hillary Clinton's smear artists. I think it was Blumenthal, Sidney Blumenthal.
Cheryl Atkinson, investigative reporters, and tell me if I'm wrong, really can't be chummy with everybody, can they? I mean, like a political reporter, you become chummy with all the other political reporters, but you guys are kind of a special breed, aren't you?
Which came first? I think before I was investigative reporter, I was not chummy with these people. They don't see me as, I don't think, their friends or allies. And a lot of people in my industry do pal around with, you know, they live in the same community with people. They see them all the time. I don't. I live way outside of D.C. So far outside of D.C., it takes me 2 or 3 hours during rush hour to get there. And I just don't
move in that world. I don't get invited to parties. Once in a while, if I do get invited to parties, I don't usually go, you know, like the parties we're talking about. And I'm comfortable there. I like being sort of outside the circle looking in. I think it just gives me a different perspective. And it's probably what helped me become an investigative reporter who could turn up things that, in some cases, that other reporters weren't turning up because I'm outside the bubble a little bit.
We're going to cut it off there, but I think you're finding out that this is a very interesting woman. And her book, The Smear, would be a really good reading in terms of understanding the underground in the news, both the legitimate and the what we would call the fake news. And I would highly recommend watching her television show also. She really is a very honest, decent investigating reporter. And let's add the fact that she's a bright woman, too. So that's going to be it for tonight. We're going to ask Vera Lynn to sign us off as she usually does, singing that wonderful song, We'll Meet Again. Happy New Year.
We'll meet again. Don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know, tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing this song. We'll meet again. Don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.